Welcome to the Banjo Studio Podcast. From Banjo Studio, your source for the finest in North American-made banjos and Collings guitars and mandolins. Go to banjostudio.com on the web for an incredible selection of instruments and accessories. Hello, this podcast from March 18th, 2020 is with the extraordinary banjo player, virtuoso, Mr. Ryan Cavanaugh.
This is the first podcast that we're doing with the Banjo Studio, and so I'm very interested to do it. I'm actually not a banjo player, so you'll have to excuse me if I slip up a lot. I am a musician.
Even better.
I'm a guitar player, yeah, so I have a limitation on how deep I can get with you.
All banjo players want to talk about is gear, so that makes me really happy.
Oh, yeah, no, I cannot do that. I once had a banjo. I sold it for a guitar again.
Fantastic. They're like Harley Davidson owners. They're always like, oh, what kind of nuts and brackets do you use? Oh, what kind of... I mean, it's the most customizable acoustic instrument. So that's all they end up wanting to talk about. So this is great.
That's fantastic. So, I did look into your into some of your work. Some of the background of your work. Your records sound fantastic, and so that's been real interesting learning about that. And I know,
great, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, I was put on the mission partially because I think we share an interest in John McLaughlin's work, and my friend said you got to hear this guy. It's really impacted by John, and I thought that'd be interesting. So. But I was interested mostly in what your journey was to get there from what it seems like I'd heard that your background was in fairly, I don't want to say straight bluegrass, but, you know, more country-based, older styles.
Yeah.
Of playing the banjo and how you managed to, what was the pathway that led you to the kind of sounds that you're playing with now?
Yeah, there's this, just my early upbringing had a lot to do with what sounds influenced me. And my father listens to everything. If someone recommended a record to him, he'd buy it. And so I grew up hearing like John Williams' greatest hits with the Boston Pops, like all the movie themes. I heard my father had the first CD player he could get his hands on, so that was one of the first CDs he had. Before that, it was Doc Watson records, Flat and Scruggs, Eagles. Then when he got a CD player, I heard a lot of John Williams movie themes, you know, from the Western themes to Superman. Then I heard Andreas Vollenweider from Switzerland.
Oh, yeah.
The synth composer.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like all across the board. I was also hearing Irish traditional music because my father's, he comes from an Irish family.
Yes.
And they're all Irish. So, but, you know, a lot of blues, bluegrass. I mean, it was all across the board, really. I was really lucky. Was really, really lucky, from Tchaikovsky to Peter and the Wolf to The Rite of Spring. I heard everything. I mean, it was there. And it was always there.
And, I see.
Yeah. So when I grew up, you know, I was taught to... My father is a Renaissance man of sorts, but he was my biggest influence to start off. He never told me anything was hard. So when I found his banjo, he was like, you can do this. He was like, you just take it in small chunks. Mm-hmm. And you make a goal and you chop it up and you take each piece at a time, you know, because you can't eat a whole lasagna at once. And that's, I'm not quoting him. I'm making that up on my own. So I heard Earl Scruggs and... I heard him play on a record called Will the Circle Be Unbroken?
Yes, I know.
Yeah, and that's the first time I heard it. And coincidentally, to this day, I still think that's the best fidelity and musicians that he played with. I think it was fantastic.
Yeah.
The B-side record of that with all the instrumentals was just unbelievable. And it still influences me to this day. But there's a true grit to the way those guys played that really struck a chord with me.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it was Bill Monroe. And for some for some people with some other folks, but when I heard Doc Watson, Earl Scruggs, Vassar Clements, and Jimmy Martin together, I don't know what it did, but it caught me as a kid, and I had to learn how to play like that.
Yeah.
So, and that kind of true grit led me down this path. Mm-hmm. And this path, I got to become, you know, a decent banjo player in my first 2 years. And then my parents took a job transfer to Mount Airy, North Carolina. And I knew, because I'd read the Earl Scruggs instructional manual, I knew that he was from North Carolina. So it didn't take me long to realize that it was everywhere. Everybody's uncle, everybody's grandfather played the fiddle. Earl Scruggs was like Paul Bunyan in that part of North Carolina. Everyone had a story about the guy. I mean, you know, from old timers to young people that saw him in the grocery store. It was in the place I lived was the hometown of Andy Griffith. So the legends were either Earl Scruggs or Andy Griffith. I saw once, you know, so it didn't take me long to like immerse myself as a kid, and my parents got free babysitting with all the jam sessions around. I mean, I was 11 years old, and I just had old timers around. I didn't have anybody my age around. Nobody was there to tell me it was hard.
Uh-huh.
You know, I kind of did what I did, and I didn't realize bluegrass banjo was hard. I just wanted to do it, and it was more fun than video games.
Uh-huh.
And so I started progressing, and people started buying me banjo records for gifts. Oh, I saw this at a store, and I'll bring this to you. I saw this at a store. So somebody, I think it was my mother, bought me, you know, a Bela Fleck and the Flecktones CD. It was Flight of the Cosmic Hippo.
Uh-huh.
And I heard that, and I was like, wow, this is different. You know, it reminds me of some of the bebop my dad listened to. And so I'd heard bebop, and some of the informational programming on TV and stuff on, you know, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers. I'd heard jazz. I was like, oh, this is cool. All right. How do I start learning how to do this? And so I hope I'm not being long-winded here. I'll take breaks if you feel free to interject.
Oh, no. Keep going. This is good. This is a story. I'm not that kind of interviewer. I kind of like to listen to the story, actually, which is what the question I asked. So feel free, please. You know.
Oh, great. Yeah. And so it just so happened that around the time I was like, how the hell do I learn this stuff? You know, I was in some old bookstore gift shop in this tiny little town I lived in Mount Airy, North Carolina. And I found this book by a guy named Tony Trischka called Melodic Banjo.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to look at the pictures on the cover to make sure it was the right kind of banjo. I'm like, all right, it has the fifth, it has five strings. All right. And I had to flip through the books. I'd never heard of this before. And I'd heard of this guy named Bill Keith. And I was like, all right. They mentioned that guy's name in the book. I heard he's, you know, a heavy dude. A heavy player. I have to do this. I have to buy this book. So I bought the book. I started learning it. And then my parents weren't showbiz parents. They really didn't care. I think they were just happy I wasn't like shooting off firecrackers in the neighborhood and stuff, you know?
Uh-huh.
Or getting in trouble somehow playing video games or whatever. But so one day my mother just said, you're doing pretty good at banjo. You want some lessons? There's a lot of people to choose from here to take lessons. I was like, well, yeah, sure. And so she called around, and all these old rednecks, I can't say that in an interview, but all these old timers there were like, oh, we can't teach him because he's too good now. You know, I've been learning that book for almost a year, and they were like, but there's one guy here. He knows Rex. His name's Rex McGee, and he knows Bela Fleck. He studied with Bela Fleck. He knows Bela Fleck. So she brings me to this guy, and I actually ran into this guy. I was 11 years old. He was 21, and I ran into him at a talent contest that I entered to win $50 at a local church. And this guy got on stage and played Charlie Parker, Donna Lee, and he played Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee. And I said, man, this guy's a bad motherfucker. You know, I got to take lessons with him. Finally, I know his name. And I stalked this guy. And he ended up being like my my guru for a while.
Goodness. Wow. All right.
Yeah. And he pretty much gave me, he said, who are you listening to? And I said, who are you listening to outside of bluegrass? And I said, well, I'm listening to this guy, Bela Fleck. And this guy knew his stuff. He knew the solos from it. And he said, but I don't want to play that. I want to sound like me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you sound like? And he started, the only thing I knew when I was a kid, he was playing Charlie Parker shit on the banjo.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I was like, wow, Bela Fleck is not doing that.
Uh-huh.
And I realized right away that on those Bela Fleck records, the only guy doing that was the piano player.
Uh-huh.
And so I started going back and listening to those piano solos. And then I found, I didn't really know who to go for yet, but I was like, how do I get started on playing like you? And he said, well, learn how to read music. Okay. And everything from, I was like, isn't that hard? He's like, ah, it's not hard. Get a book at the library. You know, go get a book at the library. Okay. So I did. And then I just, everything kind of fell in place by mistake. I found a book at a bookstore called Improvising Jazz by Jerry Coker.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about 16 when I found that book, and I did all the paperwork in that book. It's a heavy book for homework.
Yeah.
You know, here's all your scales and modes, transcribe them into every key, learn how to play them. All right, now learn to play them in thirds. You know, fourths and fifths and sixths and whatnot. So I did that, and I'd moved away from this guy at the time. And so I let my influences take over. And my father had said at the time, he goes, I don't want you just to become a banjo nerd. I want you to learn some other stuff. So I bought you this electric guitar. And I was pissed because I didn't want an Arctic White Stratocaster. I thought that was some Beach Boys shit. You know, I wanted the heavy metal guitar that looked like a medieval, like, you know, weapon. I really did. I wanted, if I was going to learn guitar, I wanted to learn metal. That's what I thought when I was in school.
Wow. So.
And I was mad, but I took the guitar and I did what he said. He said, I want you to learn some Stevie Ray Vaughan. I want you to learn how to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And I said, okay. So I listened to Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I took a lesson from a guy in town who I heard in this new town I was living in. It sounded like Stevie Ray Vaughan. He was reluctant to teach me to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan because he was trying to have his own sound. but I didn't know what to ask, you know, when I was a kid. I was young.
Uh-huh.
And so, but Stevie Ray Vaughan had True Grit, you know, and he had this grit that I was looking for that Doc Watson had, that Earl Scruggs had. He had this loping swing to the way he played.
Right.
And maybe that's it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's timing or something.
Yeah, rhythmic feel.
Yeah, the rhythmic feel really got me, I guess. It was all really danceable when you'd hear these guys play. And not even danceable, it just made you want to move. It didn't sound like math.
Yeah, yeah.
They were taking this complexity and making it sound like humane.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's what grabbed me. But so I got into Stevie Ray Vaughan. I started buying guitar player magazines, and I said, okay, you know, I have a plan because someday I'm going to get an electric banjo. So I'm going to have to learn about this electric guitar shit. And I'm going to have to like crossbreed this with the banjo for when I get this electric banjo. So I might as well learn as much as I can about electric guitar right now.
Mm-hmm.
So an electric guitar magazine interview with somebody said that Eric Johnson had learned from Stevie Ray Vaughan. And it was time. I think this was an advertisement at the time, like 1997 or 8, where Eric Johnson put out this VHS set of his playing method. So I cut grass until I could afford this. And I bought it. And he's like, all right, the scales and modes, you know, pentatonic and diatonic. And I learned that the best I could. And so I was like, all right. So I started applying it to the banjo, but it was sounding, I didn't want to just play guitar shit on the banjo, you know, but I had no other way to do this. So this was all just an experiment. And my mother was happy to be buying me books instead of video games and stuff. So I found some book called Speed Lead for Heavy Metal Guitar.
Mm-hmm. And,
I went to the back and it had the tablature and the staff notation to Flight of the Bumblebee. That was the last song in the book. So we were supposed to be able to shred like Yngwie Malmsteen. You know, and so I went directly to the back of this book. I read about John McLaughlin and all these people. I didn't even know who they were. And so I took the staff notation, and with the help of the guitar tablature, I turned it into banjo tablature. And then I took this three-finger style on the banjo, which is going like on the X-axis across the strings, like arpeggiated, you know, from bluegrass style. And I took, to be able to play Flight of the Bumblebee, I had to take playing across the X-axis to moving my fingers along the Y-axis.
Uh-huh.
So I would use pick with three fingers on one string in order to get the three chromatic notes on each string. And I figured out a method to pick through that song to play it up to speed with the demonstration on the recording. So this is where I started becoming really onto something of my own. And I checked in with that teacher of mine from North Carolina, Rex McGee, and I was like, here's what I'm doing. You know, I heard you play Flight of the Bumblebee. This is the way I do it. I know it's wrong because I haven't been living around you. He goes, no. The rest of us are just doing that with thumb index. You're playing it like a flamenco guitar player. You're really onto something. Keep doing that. Right. And he goes, by the way, are you listening to any jazz guitar players? And I said, yeah, I'm listening to Wes Montgomery and Pat Metheny. And he goes, that's cool and all, but you need to listen to John McLaughlin. And I said, why? He goes, and he just goes, because this son of a bitch plays like a fucking man. I was like, what? And he just said that to light a fire under me. He said it with a smile on his face, and he goes, check him out. So I went to the record store. I think I was 19, and I was living near Philadelphia at the time, and I just bought his newest record. It was called The Heart of Things.
Right.
Uh-huh. It had Dennis Chambers on it. Mm-hmm. And Matthew Garrison and some other guys. But right away, Dennis Chambers got me. I was like, wait a minute. This guy has that timing like the dudes that I like.
Uh-huh.
Only this is the first drummer that I've ever really noticed. You know?
Uh-huh.
I'm a huge fan. Right away, I wore that record out. I'm on my like fifth copy of that CD. I still have.
That's great.
I just keep buying it. But it took me a couple years to be able to tell John McLaughlin's guitar tone from the synthesizer on the record. I couldn't tell when they were trading which one was, because I'd never heard a hollow body guitar with chorus on it before. It was just a strange sound.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, all this time goes by. I'm getting to my point here. But all this time goes by and I study this stuff. I get into Shakti. I get into, you know, some Mahavishnu. That was too wild for me. I didn't understand it.
Uh-huh. I understood
the heart of things better.
Interesting.
Just because the sounds were more familiar in the modern context, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I listened to Pat Metheny, Imaginary Day, and I had an electric banjo at that time, so I was really like, you know, these guys weren't playing guitar licks on their guitars. They weren't playing licks at all.
Yeah.
Which is what I was going for the whole time. I was like, I don't want to play licks. You know, I want to play like I'm speaking. So, anyway, I moved back to North Carolina. I started playing Celtic music just to get a gig at a local bar.
Mm-hmm.
I got pretty proficient at that over the years, but I was playing in bluegrass bands, trying out this John McLaughlin stuff that I had learned by ear and some ways of navigating different modes and stuff. And I was really pissing off a lot of bluegrass players, but I was going to jams to be able to practice this stuff. together a band in college to experiment with this stuff, and took them on the road for 3 years. And you know, there were some slackers in the band, and I didn't really reach the place where I wanted to, because I wasn't being challenged. I was challenged rhythmically. The drummer was great, but harmonically, these guys didn't understand intervallic chord substitution, different things that I was trying to go for. Playing changes. They didn't get playing changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you'd be backfooted. Seriously. It was your own band.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I disbanded and just kind of floated, and I joined some local bluegrass band in North Carolina. And anyway, to make a long story shorter, I was dating a girl who had been playing banjo as long as I have. And apparently she didn't practice like I had with any kind of, I mean, I was obsessed.
Yes, you can hear that.
With this. Yeah. You know, when you really get, when you're getting somewhere and you're inspired by your accomplishments, it keeps inspiring you to do more. And this was just all discovery. You know, Bela Fleck was the first person to do this. And this guy, Rex McGee, was the second. And he was out there playing professionally too, but he didn't go electric. I just saw a lot of potential with volume.
Uh-huh.
And because it was just cool. Rock and roll's cool. Drums and bass are cool. Electric guitar's cool.
Uh-huh.
And so this girl, I was gigging at night, and she had to get a day job because she couldn't get gigs. And we're back in North Carolina. She got mad, and I was living with her, and I was short on rent 1 month, and she's like, I'm done. Her jealousy came out. Her passive aggression turned into an explosion. And she freaks on me and tells me to take your dog and your stupid banjo and get the fuck out, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what am I supposed to do? Where do I go? She's like, I don't know. Why don't you call John McLaughlin? That's all you ever fucking talk about. Right? So I did. I guessed his email. I stalked him on the internet, and I was poor and broke, and I was working my first day job in a very long time and sleeping on some hippie's couch.
Mm-hmm.
And I guessed his email. I mean, I guessed 30 emails. I spent a week doing this, and I sent this same email to Bela Fleck, Mark O'Connor, Pat Metheny, Joni Mitchell. I can go down a list, like all our favorite musicians. I just went for a Hail Mary here.
Uh-huh.
And the only one I heard back from was John McLaughlin.
Wow.
And I keep pronouncing his name different each time because
it's all right. I don't know.
But it's the only one I heard back from. And he liked the bravery in my email of desperation.
Uh-huh.
And I had told him at the end of it, I said, P.S. if I don't hear back from you, I'm gonna bug the ever loving shit out of you. that's what it said. And he thought it was funny. He thought it was really funny that someone had the balls to say that to him. You know, he's Mah Vishnu, you know.
That's right.
And so he told me to go into a studio and make him, he said he wanted some MP3s, and this was 2001 or no, this was 2005.
Uh-huh.
I didn't even know what an MP3 was.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, I want you to go into the studio and make me 3 improvised MP3s. I want you to improvise.
Uh-huh.
do what you can do and do it best. And I said, okay. So I went, I found a kid, a hungry college kid whose parents had let him put a studio in their upstairs. And he had me over and he recorded me playing three improvisations. And his mom helped me convert this stuff to MP3s because, well, she happily did it because she knew who John McLaughlin was.
Wow. Wow, how fantastic.
And I sent him this music, and he said he was really impressed. Wow, I've never heard a banjo sound like that. And I was like, wow, who knew? You know, who knew? You know, he goes, he said, it just so happens that the saxophonist Bill Evans, who was in my band in the 80s, who I didn't know who listens to jazz past 1980, not me.
Uh-huh.
But he said this guy had joked to him about a month ago and asked him if he knew any banjo players because he had heard Bela Fleck and he wanted to do a project like that.
Uh-huh.
I thought McLaughlin was joking, but he called me back and said, you're going to hear from Bill Evans. He needs a banjo in his band. And I went up there and auditioned and got the gig and met John a month later in Monte Carlo. And, you know, I was on my first record with Bill Evans and Dennis Chambers and Victor Wooten. And I never expected to get there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
But luckily, when I got that manila envelope full of all those scores, I knew how to read that shit. Because I would have been really up Schitt's Creek if I did not know how to read.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And that was the main thing that they were concerned about. Can you read these charts? And I did.
That's amazing. What a story. So thank you for going through the whole story of how you got there. A couple of questions come up from what you were talking about. In terms of... Well, I would say this. So, you know, what strikes me is that you just have a great hunger and fascination with music and are really driven in direction and are clearly disciplined in order to learn to do what you want to do, what you have in your head, which I think is really incredible on a plain music level. But there's something that I keep reading that's a way that people talk of you, which they say that you're a technical player. And this is very confusing to me. I'm trying to understand whether you agree with that and what is meant by that as opposed to a non-technical player, especially where you use the term grit a lot to describe people whose work you liked. And there's, I think, it's a connotation between grit and technical. Technically seems like something slick and less connected to, there's not a technical way to grit. Exactly, it's a feel thing. So I want to look into that with you, if you don't mind going up that direction.
Yeah, no problem. I think that comes from my Indian classical training, which I had to do. If I was going in that McLaughlin direction, like I said, a lot of this stuff just fell into place. I mean, I went to college for fine art and graphic design.
Uh-huh.
So I applied. I've been drawing since I was a kid, and I don't know if I'm on the autistic spectrum or if I had something going on, but I traced and traced and traced things out of books until I could draw them freehand. And then before you knew it, I could render a black and white photograph to where you couldn't tell the difference.
Uh-huh.
And I applied that to a lot of things that I learned musically. But then when I saw, you know, if I drew freehand, I could mix a dinosaur with a tiger, or I could have the will to, you know, to put bat wings on an elephant. So I have this stylistically. I think that's where I'm thinking of thinking outside the box. But as far as technicality, I had to explore all of these for some reason. I don't know what my deal is. I just had to learn about all these things. But I met an Indian sarod player. I was in North Carolina, and I was in the Triangle, where there was a lot of, you know, Indian nationals.
Mm-hmm.
Working in the software industry, I met a guy that played the sarod and a guy that played the tablas. And they were in a band they called Hindu Grass. And they thought it was amazing that they found me and I liked John McLaughlin. So they were like, why don't you be in our band? And I was like, okay. So I studied with these guys for about a year, and then they took me out to play Indian weddings.
Wow.
And, you know, so there's a lot of technical skill that came from playing North Indian and South Indian classical music.
So were they, let's talk about that split for a minute. South Indian classical music, were they South Indian or North Indian? Or what was their background?
Well, it seems like tabla players, really, the sarod player, he was coming from a North Indian classical, Ali Akbar Khan kind of background. Real stiff. And the tabla player was doing mridangam and tabla. So he was studying both North and South. And so I got a big dose of all this, and it was really confusing for a while. I was like, why is one of these so like free to improvise on, and the other one's so like structured? And that's when I learned about Carnatic music and about how the South Indian style is more improvisational in a lot of ways. It's still really confusing, but I wasn't trying to be an Indian musician. I was just trying to get some of that curry to put in my dish.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I hope I don't sound like I'm culturally appropriating, but I was just trying to get some of that Indian spice because it has the drive that bluegrass does.
Oh, there's a whole world there. Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's very, very rhythmically sophisticated, so you can
learn. Yeah, and it drives like bluegrass. The whole reason I got into McLaughlin's playing is because he was technical like bluegrass. And I just think it's really funny that a lot of these banjo players, including Bela Fleck, refer to my technicality. I'm playing as many notes as any of them are. I'm just playing my notes differently. I decided to go for a linear approach to navigating harmony as opposed to an arpeggiated approach. And it looks really technical. I mean, when you see me going for what I'm going for, there's a lot of fingers flying, and it's much less, elegant looking than Bela Fleck's very banjoistic left hand. But I'm not going for banjo music. The banjo is just what I'm painting with.
So. Let's talk about that for a minute, too. Let's talk about painting with a banjo and the limitations there. I mean, the guitar has a similar limitation, only a little bit less, and we overcome it with effects and stuff. But sustain is the first thing. So once you're into playing those kind of lines or getting things like that, it's sort of integrated somewhat. I'm going to ask this question from the position of it's somewhat integrated in the background of music, even from the transition to from harpsichords to pianos and stuff, which is sustain is an issue for certain kinds of landscape. I don't know how to put it. More landscaped lines or more varied articulation in the lines. So, is there a way that you've looked at that particular musical thing in terms of the banjo, which doesn't have much sustain? It was a natural situation.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you can hear some of that when I first started really touching on that on acoustic banjo. On electric banjo, I've had sustain the whole time. So the electric banjo really helped me look at the acoustic banjo differently. But this whole time I was messing around with musics and genres, I was also like tinkering with my banjo. So I went through head tension, bridge height, bridge weight, tailpiece height. You know, different types of tail pieces, string gauges, frets, you name it. And what's really funny is I landed on my final string gauge, string gauges, tail piece height, bridge height setup. I landed on this and I was like, okay, I got it. I have sustain on the banjo now. Not like perpetuated one note creamy overdrive sustain, but like the kind of sustain a piano would have. And I happened to land on the exact way Bela Fleck sets up his banjo, so that was very validating. I knew something was going right, that I was tuning my head in F or G, you know, F sharp or in between there, and my string gauges were a certain way and my bridge was a certain height. I was like, oh, wow. I know how neurotic that guy is. You know, that he's, I mean, Bale is as into this as I was, and he's been at it much longer. So I knew I was in the right ballpark, but, there's a recording I did of my favorite things on a record called An East Nashville Christmas.
Uh-huh.
And you can dig for it on YouTube and hear it, but it's just banjo and Rhodes, and you can hear all the space in there. But when you get your banjo set up right, it really can sustain like a guitar or a piano.
Killer. Uh-huh.
But the problem is the bluegrass nomenclature says that you need to crank that head. And you need to sand down that bridge, and you need to crank that tailpiece down to get that fucker as loud as you can. Because for some reason, banjo players have this like insecurity about being banjo players, but they can be the loudest instrument in a bluegrass band, which somehow gives them some sort of validation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it is. There's a whole culture. It's a cult.
See, the banjo cults, yes. I know, here I am interviewing on behalf of the banjo cults. It's really great.
Yeah. But if you get a really high bridge and it's reasonably thick and you tune your head and, you know, F or F sharp, and you put the gauges of strings on it that I use, 10, 11, 13, 21, 10.
It's our gauges. That's funny, yeah.
Yeah, you get the right combination of
of
tonality meets volume meets sustain, and that's kind of I just arrived there by mistake.
I did notice you're selling your own bridges to people, which I thought was interesting. You have your own bridge design, so that was
That's for the electric banjo, and that's because the electric banjo with the wooden bridge, there's humbuckers under there.
Uh huh.
And the company Deering that makes them was taking these wooden bridges and they were gluing metal to the feet so the humbucker would pick them up from under the head, and it was still feeding back with overdrive and chorus and, you know, the standard guitar effects that you want to use. And I'd have to get a guitar multi-effects processor and EQ out a bunch of stuff, and I just said, I want this to be easy like a guitar.
Uh-huh.
I just want to be able to plug in and have it sound good. And so that bridge was the that solved my problem with effects making it feedback and not as much sustain as I wanted and things like that. It just kind of like tamed it.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
No, it's interesting. I think we have another, we have a friend in common, my friend Doug Belote, who plays, was up there for a while. Oh, yeah. Doug's a good friend of mine down here. And so I wanted to get back to this rhythmic thing with playing, because it seems like you've been in two universes. And obviously when you went to Bill Evans's band, you were probably encountering players like that. So it must make a big difference for the kind of music that you're in to be playing with drummers that are, especially, I don't know so much McLaughlin. What McLaughlin does is out in odd time signatures and stuff, and people have to be very comfortable doing that. Not that you're doing what he's doing, but I just mean that language is there.
So. Yeah, I wanted to speak that language, and I wanted out. I didn't want to be. I'm not from the South. My family's from outside New York City, North Jersey. Mm-hmm. So, like, I just my whole life, even in the South, those the banjo jokes and like you're a hillbilly, and like you get somebody finds out you play the banjo, they do a little dance, mm-hmm. and they just. I saw an opportunity there with, I went to school for all this like pinky in the air fine art, you know, and the artistic philosophy was find something of controversy
and
make it your style. Because art, the artistic philosophy that they teach you when you're in one of these high-end art schools is if it doesn't have controversy, it's not art. It can't be art if it's not controversial. Somebody has to hate it. Somebody has to like it. If it's not that, it's just like your wall painted yellow.
I was in a high end art school too. So yeah.
Anyway, nice. Okay, so you get it.
Yeah.
The banjo came with this ball and chain, you know, stereotype. It wasn't like the elegant Spanish European stereotype of the guitar, you know, the ancient thing. It was slavery. It was stolen from this oppressed people that were stolen from another country with their banjos, and then it was claimed for the hillbillies.
Yeah.
You know, and it
yeah.
It's real complex. And I hated the jokes. I just hated them. And I thought Bela Fleck was so cool for what he had done with the you know, with that instrument, you know. And so I'm losing track of your question here, but oh yeah, so I wanted out of the cultiness of bluegrass. Not that I don't like it, and there's players that I love, but like as a subculture, jazz and blues and electric music and drummers and electric guitar players and bass players are much more friendly and open to eclectic broadening. I don't know what to say. Eclectic, you know, venturing out than the bluegrass world is.
Uh-huh.
They're not as conservative. Some of them are, but as a whole, I was like, man, I want to hang around drummers and bass players and electric guitar players. These guys are much cooler than these.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
These real stiff types that I was hanging out with.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If you play the way those bluegrassers say you're supposed to, they love you, and I can do that just fine. But that's not it's like restricting your speech only to Elizabethan English, you know. Who wants to do that? What's fun in that? So
yeah I have the same thing. I mean, I play a lot of classical music, Yiddish music and stuff, and so I you know, you come across always this world of people where it's extremely rigid and what you're supposed to be doing. And of course I played electric guitar in that music, so I relate to what you're saying very much. I see that.
Yeah, and
of course,
apparently the beboppers are like that, the late 60s post bop guys are like that, the fusion guys are like that. But as a banjo player in that world, everybody loved me. I was just like, this is great, I have friends everywhere, this is fantastic, you know.
What I think a last question, because I mean, you talk so much in a really clear way, so I haven't really had to ask many questions, and it's great that it's that.
Right, and I hope I haven't bored you.
Not at all. I don't think it's boring at all. I mean, I think listen, you got a real musical story. It's no part of it's boring, and I think it touched on a whole musical journey through a lot of things. And actually, I want to go further with that to ask, what are you driving for now? Considering that you've done all that and accomplished all that, and you've been interested in those directions, what are you looking for now?
I'm still trying to get better all the time. I'm not one of those guys that just settles. I'm still on the path, you know, the means to a way, but there's not an end. I just keep going, and it's like, you know, the phases of an artist like Picasso. So since I went to school, I'm like, well, I'm into this now, so I'm going to try this. And I'm into this now, so I'm going to try this. And I'm really into electronic music right now. I got into Mark Giuliana, the drummer, and Tim LaFave, the bass player. And I'm still ingesting stuff from a couple lessons I took from Pat Martino a couple years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I'm integrating some of that, but you know, I'm just still trying to get better all the time. I'm learning the jazz standards that I like. And what's really great is I go back and forth between the acoustic and electric banjo. And when I get sick of one or I get tired of one, I have the other that's there. And I always have some fresh ideas because I can go back and forth. But there's a mix of, I want to try to integrate the banjo through the Indian sounds that it can make and some of the harmonic minor sounds that it can make into this kind of world hybrid of, you know, some kind of electronic Indian, maybe Western groove music of some sort. I don't know. So not hip hop. I don't want to make some cheesy hip hop, but I just want to use modern sounds and just try to integrate the banjo into that, like in an with a really ancient sound to it.
What did you pick up from Pat Martino? Tell me about that experience. Legendary Pat.
You know what? I just pretty much got another angle of how McLaughlin looks at the conservatory way that he learned theory. You know, McLaughlin's all about the scales and the modes and the chords that come from each one of those, and like you compartmentalize, you know, you have your diatonic scale and you have your pentatonic scale, and then there's, you know, diminished and augmented and altered and a whole tone, and mixing those all together to create a sound. And when you play, you know, to navigate scales and modes, or to navigate changes freely with parts of those tonalities in from each one of those scales, you know. You know, like going off the root, going half whole off the root of a dominant chord for as long as you can until the next change comes along, and then making a decision to come back down pentatonically into that change, or slicing up a you know, a relative minor chord that you have to navigate with a you know, a flat six and a major seven, going right off of it, kind of altering stuff at liberty seems to be what McLaughlin's all about. But Martino just had a different way of doing it. He's doing the same thing. He just had a different way of explaining it. And it seems to me like he explains it in a fretboard geometry. So he kind of looks at the fretboard and the tuning of the guitar as if you laid an infinite amount of guitar fretboards and octaves next to the one you already have, right? So it's like a spiral. So imagine your fretboard as a cylinder, like that piano that goes all the way around, like 360 degrees. He thinks of his fretboard like that. So, like a giant slide rule. So when he wants to get a certain sound, like when you overlay, you know, when you can like take a dominant chord and then you can sub out like minor pentatonic from the root, right? And then you can sub that out even further and play major off the flat seven of the dominant. And then you can take that off the flat seven and you can make that Lydian. And then you can take that Lydian and you can take that whole Lydian sharp nine chord and move that up like a half step, like Herbie Hancock. And then you have this really out substitution. Well, Pat Martino knows how to do that like globally with entire keys. Because of the way he looks at the fretboard. So he can like, he can take that ladder, whether it's the diminished ladder or the chromatic ladder, to take it out. And he can stay in that place and play over changes and not get fucked up. Like, so he's doing some really deep stuff there.
Well, yeah, you can hear that. It's a mystery. It's real interesting. Your explanation is really, really interesting. I don't think I've ever heard it before, so it's kind of fascinating.
He explains it with geometry, though, which is really confusing.
And how does he do that? I mean, what do you mean by geometry? Like,
I wish I had his book here. I lent it to a friend, but like, you know, Pat looks at inversions as a, and he can draw it on the fretboard for you if he has a diagram, but he'll draw a cube with all six sides, or how many sides is a cube at? 1, 2, 3, but yeah, six sides. And he'll draw a cube and show you, if you take it, if you take a chord shape and put it on the fretboard, like a diminished shape, and then you invert it, like, and play its mirror image to itself, you get an inversion. And he shows you how to use these inversions. Then he relates that to an entire key and tells you why it works. It's almost like Herbie Hancock's negative harmony deal. If you listen to that video of him talk about negative harmony, it's kind of the same.
I haven't heard him do it, but I do know about the negative harmony thing, absolutely.
So, yeah. So, I mean, there are some... Pat and John are looking at music theory the same way, but they're kind of breaking the rules in a different way.
Right, right.
You know, if you can even call their... I mean, jazz is breaking the rules of classical music. But
yeah.
They just go about it different because John is more chromatic in his approach. And Martino is very... He's very structured in his, you know, he'll just play substitutions the whole time with a scale. But McLaughlin is more emotional in that he'll bring it back.
Right.
He'll bring it. Right. He'll bring it back to the you know, the root scale. So anyway. No, I just could go on and on forever about this.
Yeah, it's intriguing. I'm trying to get back. I think probably for the listeners, I could go up there with you for another forever. I'm fascinated with this stuff, but probably we got to get back to the fact that you're a banjo player. I hate to do that to you, but you know. But
no, that's fine. This was all a challenge to do on the banjo because the tuning is real cattywampus. I mean, it's like the first four strings of the guitar with a with an E string dropped down to a D, and then you have this string on the top that's a G octave.
What made you keep that tuning to do what you're doing?
You know, that's a really good question, because my teacher, Rex McGee, he eventually tuned it in all fourths up from the D, D, G, C, F. I don't know. I think I just kept it that way just because... I had already done that much work and I didn't see any point in changing it. He changed it right in the middle of his career. He just said, I'm making the switch. And I said, well, you know, they're equally as hard, you know, so everything has its challenges. So I'll leave it like it is. I just think that's how I did it. I found my tricks in my comfort zones and I left them where they were. But the half hole is definitely... The diminished scale is definitely the hardest thing to do on it, and that's kind of what I'm really exploring on right now. Liking how it goes once I memorize a scale pattern. It's, you know, it takes years of ingesting it, of course, but you start to see it everywhere in jazz when you start reading through somebody else's solo. So yeah, but a lot of those scales, those jazz scales, they sound very nice with the tonality of the banjo. Like the harmonic minor scale sounds absolutely lovely, and it just breaks all these stereotypes on the banjo. You know, this major scale happy thing that everybody hears, you know, but you can really hear some of the banjo's history when you play melodic or harmonic minor on it. And so I'm into that. I'm really into that right now. So,
well, listen, I don't want to keep you, even though we're all stuck inside until further notice or whatever it is. I don't know how it is up where you are, but here it's pretty getting more and more rigid. By every 6 hours, you get a pronouncement. So,
I don't mind if you have more questions. If I'm not wearing you out, I'm happy to do it. I hope I'm not talking too much in. I don't want to sound like one of those interviewer guys that's like, that like, I know it all. And like, but I'm happy to answer these questions because I rarely get non-banjo questions.
Oh, well, that's good. And
it's just delightful to not have to answer all those questions. Well, they ask dumb questions.
if I was to ask more questions, and it would be more up of a non-banjo, it just is straight music stuff. Now, the interesting thing here is that you're very into McLaughlin, and then you end up with Bill Evans, so you're very much in the in people that are, you know, heavily impacted by being in Miles Davis's space. And what did you learn from that? You know, there's something that strikes me as a musician from dealing with musicians who deal that played with Miles Davis, which is they have an amazing way of feeling, creating a kind of space within any piece of music that's being improvised on as a group. And it can be quite, it's really riveting. And so I would ask what came away from improvising with people that had that as a basic spatial situation. That's just my perception. I'm not saying that's what they're doing. You may have a different...
You're absolutely right. They all have something. That club has something real special that they all got from Miles, and it's this... It's this use of space and this really, like, coy use of blue notes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I could go as far as to say as it is diminished scale and harmonic minor scale, because when you listen to Miles go dark, people are always calling him the Prince of Darkness. I don't know if that's because he was a jerk or because his music had a little tinge of that in it. But that came from, like, the flamenco influence in his music. He loved Spanish music.
Uh-huh.
He absolutely loved it, according to McLaughlin. And you can hear it, after it was pointed out to me on Sketches of Spain, you can hear it in his 60s stuff with Wayne Shorter.
Uh-huh.
And you can really hear them both kind of go for that. But the use of space really, really... I mean, I know it sounds so simple, and everybody hears that with Miles. Oh, Miles, he used the space, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But that and that dark tinge of blue notes and diminished notes really, really sets that club apart.
Yes, and also something temporally so that when you make any gestures like that, there's kind of been a space created somehow in the rhythmic situation and in the space... in the general space of the band for things like that and for new experiments to have, you know, the weight and the penetration, not like they're going by like you're just saying meaningless stuff. That's quite striking, you know.
So. Yeah, inspired me. And I mean, you know, people that haven't listened to a lot of McLaughlin's music either, and I don't want to... he seems to be a central part of this interview, but I mean, he's remained my friend. I talked to him just a week ago.
Yeah.
And I get advice from all the time, and you know,
I follow him on Twitter, so you know, I pulled down the Midgick thing the other day, and I thought that was really clear. Just Midgick for you listeners is this you can do MIDI without all the MIDI gear now with this nice, very, 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 very affordable plugin that goes on a thing. So it's funny. I actually follow him pretty closely too off his Twitter thing, and actually. It's, because it goes back to the interesting thing is the new record that they just decided to give everyone for free under the circumstance was, you know, you were saying the difference between the guitar and the synthesizer, and now it's very uncanny on that record. You're like,
oh, yeah, it's almost like what he. It, coincidentally enough, he didn't like the sound of on my latest record. He didn't like my synthesizer sounds.
Oh, that's
he called to discuss that with me.
Wow.
And I said, wait a minute. I said, not everybody likes your synthesizer sounds. And he laughed. He laughed, but I told him, I said, I like the Moog synth sound. I'm going for a Moog thing. And you know, you have all these software companies throwing their free plugins at you because you're John McLaughlin and you've been playing synthesizers forever. You know, I want a pedal. I don't want to play with a computer on stage. And, you know, I'm just going for a different thing. And he was trying to tell me what a synthesizer should do. And I said, you're still pioneering this stuff, man. There's no one who can actually say what a synthesizer should be doing on a guitar or a banjo. Uh-huh. You know, when you hook it up with one. But I said to him, either way, art isn't art unless it's controversial. And that even means if you don't like it. And he laughed. So he really appreciated me kind of enlightening him to that side of things, which was really funny.
That's great. Yeah.
I find his bravery the most inspirational thing about him. That guy is not scared to try some new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always fresh. It's always freshly trying something too. I very much love that. And, and plus I love Indian music and Indian stuff. So it's always intriguing to me. Not that I've ever really on a technical level been able to get anywhere on the instrument like that, but certainly I'm highly inspired by it in terms of the way that I feel my way through music and still keep trying to experiment. So it's a constant inspiration, you know,
the intervals and the way he harmonized it on that record is really, it's fantastic. I still have to, it takes me about four or five listens through some heavy work like that to really get it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. That's the way it should be. If music has some meat to it, you know, you should have to, you know, listen to it a bunch to get the, at least this is the way I feel about it. Of course, there's candy music, yeah, enjoyable the first time through, but you know, a lot of things are, I mean,
and this was, is all, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Please go ahead. No.
The reason I'm inspired by all these cutting edge musicians, is just because banjo is still being held to that stereotype that's just holding it back, you know. It just bothers me that guitar made it to the moon and it's on its way to Mars now, and the banjo is still like digging in the dirt for the first tool, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the banjo world are afraid, if there is, you know how a lot of those old blues guys are like, man, don't learn any of that school shit. It'll ruin your feel.
Uh-huh.
Well, if there's any instrument that is like that, it possibly came from the banjo. I mean, the players in bluegrass, I wish more of them would be open to it, but they're so scared of what the next guy will think, you know, in the Church of Bluegrass, or they are afraid that it will ruin what they already have.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I found that to be completely different. I found it to be with hard work comes great freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, with great discipline comes great freedom. And the more I learned, the more free I felt. And, you know, it made me a radical on the instrument. But as far as I'm concerned, I just get to hang with you guitar players now. You know?
Yeah, well, that's good. You know, I mean, this stigma hangs with a lot of things. I play with a very good accordion player. I play with a number of accordion players, and this is an instrument. It's a fantastic instrument, too, that it has the same kind of stigma. People get very strange about, you know, what an accordion should do, what it can do, and what it is. It's extraordinary, you know, it has a similar state of sort of a being forced into a particular narrow cultural position that makes it very difficult. Right, all the players are like, how do you know it? You know, it sits there between some people who are like, no, you have to play it like this, and people that are like, no, we have to get out of that and move along. But nonetheless, it sits there like that. You know, so yeah, playing guitar is very liberating because it already made the leap. But
yeah, I've seen that on accordion too. I have a friend that plays keys, and he plays, you know, he's a great, great keys player. He's on all my records. But he gets on the accordion and, you know, plays those Herbie Hancock chords, and it's the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah, really wonderful what you can do. Listen, I think we're going to we'll end the interview, and I it's really been wonderful talking to you. Certainly it was enlightening for me. I learned a lot that I didn't know about, and I hope the banjo audience will forgive us over at Banjo Studio for talking about just music.
Yeah. I hope so, too. I appreciate you conducting such a good interview, man, and I hope I didn't say too many swear words or anything. If there's anything offensive in there, you know what to edit out.
Oh, yeah, no. We're pretty free-going over here, and it is the internet. It's not the TV, so we can, you know, we have a little bit more freedom. I appreciate it. Great meeting you.
Great meeting you, too, man. Thanks, Jonathan. I appreciate it, man.
Welcome. Take care. See ya.
All right. You too. Bye-bye.